Buddha lived 2,500 years ago. You might wonder what him and his teaching, his life, have to do with us in our modern times. How's it relevant for us? And I think that one of the clues for that is that in the name Buddha, Buddha was not his given name. Buddha was a kind of a title, and it meant to be kind of a description of him, and that the Buddha means to be awake, or sometimes the word Bodhi also means to know in some very clear way, powerful way. The Buddha is someone who has Bodhi. And it's this quality of wakefulness, of being awake, which is what is relevant for us. And down through the centuries, Buddhism has grown and developed and branched out. If you imagine it branching out in the different schools of Buddhism like different branches on a tree, awakening, hopefully, is the sap that is the which nourishes the tree, which helps the tree to grow. The sap is not the tree. Sap is not the branches, the leaves, or the flowers. But the sap is the essence that is required for all the branches, twigs, leaves, blossoms, fruits to grow and be what they are. So awakening is some quality that is kind of like nourishment for us, that allows us to bloom, allows us to flower, allows the fruit in us to come forth. And so the question is, what is this awakening of the Buddha? What is the awakening? And it can mean many different things. If we go back again to the life of the Buddha, you know, what does this have to do with us? It's hard to know anything about the Buddha, about who he really was and what his life story was. But Buddhists have made up stories about him. And it's hard to distinguish what's real from the myths that arose around him. But one of the myths, and seemingly a myth, because there's no primary source for this idea, is that the Buddha lived a sheltered life in palace until he was of a grand age of 26. It's a long time to live sheltered by your dad and protected from the world and what the world's really about, the struggles of life, the difficulties of life. And many people somehow are sheltered. We shelter ourselves. Some people live comfortable lives. Some people don't really take in what goes on in the wider world unless it comes in very graphically into your neighborhood or something like the earthquake in Japan. That wakes us up in a certain way, many people, in a way that a similar disaster in you know, some of the third world countries doesn't wake us up in the same way. Or we're shut down, or unwilling to look, we're afraid to look at something. And so we don't venture forth to see what's going on because of the fear that's there. Or perhaps we're holding on to cherished ideals, and so those ideals prevent us from seeing clearly what this world is about. There's many, many forces that keep us from really seeing what's going on here. And so this myth is symbolized by the Buddha being sequestered in his palace. You know, I imagine the palace had high walls, so you don't see what's on the other side. So, you know, what walls do you live in? I remember there was a Calvin Hobbes cartoon, where Calvin's going to build a really good snow fort so he can throw snowballs at someone. And so he's building this great, big, round fortress wall, just big enough for him to be inside, I guess. And he can't wait till it's done so he can throw I guess snowballs this, not forget her name, but some girl, that he, his nemesis in these cartoons. And then, and finally he succeeded, and he built this high wall that's, you know, as high as he can reach with his hands, I guess. And he makes this round, you know, his fort, and he's finished finally building it, only to realize that now he's trapped inside. He can't get out. Can't see anything. So we build these walls, one way or the other. Some the walls are built by attachment to comfort, some fear of facing things, and many reasons. And so this myth, the Buddha leaves the palace to see what's out in the world, and he's shocked what he finds. And some people would say it's kind of a waking up to what's really going on in this world, waking up to, you know, the way this mythic language is taught, wakes up to greed, wakes up to sickness, old age, and death, wakes up to the catastrophe, wakes up to, you know, all of us are going to face something like this sooner or later. And sometimes it's ourselves, sometimes it's our parents, sometimes it's extended communities. There's some kind of existential reality that being a human being, being living this life, which has built into it events which are usually not very welcoming, something we don't want, something that goes against the grain of how we build up a protected life, build up our palaces, what we try to keep in place, and then suddenly out of the blue we get an illness, we get the phone call from the doctor, or we get, you know, we just start getting old and our capacities diminish. I'm spending time with my elderly parents, and it's clear that their capacities are diminishing. It's also clear that they kind of know it, but they're not going to admit it. And this kind of tension, you can see this, you know, unwillingness to kind of really admit it, but kind of feel the fear that's there, the anxiety that's there connected to it, feeling, well, you know, something's changing here, it's not good, but if I turn towards it, if I admit it, then things are not going to work, things are not going to hold up, things are going to, I have to admit something, I have to change in some way that I don't want to change, or I have to admit something I really not don't want to admit at this point. And so there's a, you know, sometimes there's a kind of a waking up to things, that things aren't the way they should be, the things aren't the way we'd like them to be. And sometimes that kind of waking up is sometimes the best thing that ever happened to someone. And I've known people who were very upset when something, when the sickness, old age, and death, or the equivalent, visited them. But then, some years later, when they reflect back and see how they were changed by that, see how they made new choices for how to live their life, that they're so grateful that there was a catalyst for a radical change, big change in their life. So the Buddha's contact with the sickness, old age, and death was a catalyst for him. And, you know, the story says that he kind of left then the palace life and became a renunciant. And one way of interpreting becoming a renunciant is that it's leaving the world. And actually in Buddhism we talk about leaving the home life when you become a renunciant. And so it can seem kind of like withdrawal from the life as we usually live. But I actually prefer to interpret it in a different way. That the Buddha could have gone back in the palace and been comfortable. And what he chose to do instead was to turn towards the world and step into the world. And he stepped into the world to face it, to really deal with this and look at this deeply. This was not a withdrawal, this was an entering into. And he entered into it in the form of a renunciant, of a monk. In part, I imagine, because what other options were there back then? He couldn't have come to Hidden Villa for a retreat. You know, they didn't have retreats back then. You know, you go down to local Spirit Rock and sit a retreat. And there was no bookstores. You can go down, you know, get books. You know, some. I'm confused about this. My life. I'm depressed. I have anxiety, and you know, I just go down and find the local therapist and sign up for therapy for a few sessions. There were none back then. Well, many of the things that we use in our life to cope and deal with our life, and to come some deeper understanding about what our life is all about, was simply not available in his time and place. And there was no universities to go to, you know, to study as a young man to try to understand better. The only thing that was set up for someone who wanted to inquire, investigate, study, look deeply into the nature of this kind of life that was kind of in his scene was that of a renunciant. That was the vehicle. And perhaps if the Buddha lived today, he would have chosen a different route, but given his time and place, that's the only route that was available. So it can look like he was kind of withdrawal, but I actually see it as a very courageous stepping into. And I think that also is part of what it means to wake up. We wake up to face and enter into this life in a deeper way. We don't wake up to disappear from the world or to withdraw from it and leave the world to itself. And I think it's very unfortunate that we call these retreats retreats, because it kind of suggests this idea again of a withdrawal, you know, leaving the world behind. And there certainly is a kind of aspect of leaving our ordinary life behind, the ordinary everyday life that we live. So there is a change that happens. But why should we call it a retreat? Why isn't this like a re-entry? We're coming here to enter more deeply. And there's a way, I think, that this kind of condition here allows us to enter into more deeply our life in a certain way that we often don't have a chance to do in, you know, our ordinary existence. Many people live lives that are very busy. It seems like we're just getting more and more busy. And the busyness, in some ways, even though it keeps us engaged, sometimes gives us the illusion that we're really engaged. Sometimes we get more and more alienated from ourselves and the world around us the more busy we are. And now some of you are connected to the web in all kinds of wonderful ways. I see I have an iPhone in the last couple of months. It's a kind of beautiful thing to have. And I could see also even as the pleasure and the delight in it. It must release serotonin in my brain. And I could see, you know, oh, it's so good, you know, and I hear that ping, I get an email, and a little serotonin drop goes off, and wow, I'm all excited, you know, and get to check that email. And, you know, reading it never lives up to that little ding, the promise of the ping. So I turned off the ping. And but I could see the effect it had on me, that there's kind of a lure of something pleasurable there, but actually it was kind of alienating, kind of separating from myself, and this constant promise of a new connection, new news, new something. Some people spend a lot of time in fantasy, in thought. And to spend too much time in thought is a kind of alienation. It's kind of a virtual reality. Before we had the web, we had thoughts. and the original virtual reality. And so we would, you know, go off into fantasy. Some, not all of you, of course, but thinking about the future a lot, thinking about the past, rehearsing the wonderful speeches, conversations you're going to have with someone, or rehearsing the wonderful conversations you should have had with someone, or wonderful fantasies of whatever, fantasies of sex, fantasies of food, fantasies of delusions of grandeur, fantasies of, you know, all kinds of things. And mind goes off into these things. Or fantasies of catastrophe. Some people have amazing minds. We have amazing, human beings have this amazing capacity for imagination. It's really awesome that 5 billion years of evolution should come to us, this amazing, wonderful capacity for imagination, And then we use it for catastrophe thinking. That the worst is happening. And so we get into this world of thinking and all that. And it's not inherently wrong to do that. But I would argue that it's often that itself is often a withdrawal from reality. And in fact, part of the motivation to get into those kinds of thoughts is, for some people, is in order not to have to really face life as it is. I've had people tell me on retreat they spent a few hours on retreat having some delicious fantasy. And the context of telling that to me is that, you know, the morning was hard on retreat, so I deserved a couple of hours of fantasy, you know, to take a break and have a vacation. And, you know, I deserved it, you know. So it was really a clear choice they had, you know, to escape rather than be present to stay there. So I think of these kinds of retreats as a re-entry, as an entry into, and a chance, unparalleled chance, to enter into life in a much deeper way than we can, often in our ordinary life. Some people complain and say, well, wait a minute, you know, if I really have this exhilarating, wonderful way of entering into life when I go mountain climbing, or I like to parachute out of airplanes, and then I feel so alive and present, or, you know, or just I'd like to run, or like, you know, all these things people like to do. And these are beautiful things to do. Nothing wrong with them at all. Don't want to stop people from doing them. But there's a way in which when we use something external, like something that juices us up or gets the adrenaline going or, you know, gives us a lot of pleasure, there's a way, if we think that is entering life deeply, then more often than not we miss a chance to really go deep, to really connect in a deep way. Because again, it's entering into something that's or it's not really allowing us to go deep into ourselves. And I would say to enter into the world deeply, or to use the ancient Buddhist language, to be a home leaver, to leave home, to leave the usual domestic life, so that we can feel deeply at home here. To discover how to carry our home with us wherever we go, to feel the depth of life, the depth of ourselves, and in that depth of being connected to ourselves, then connect to the world through that depth, with that depth. If we are living already a superficial life, or a very busy life, so we can't really feel ourselves very well or know deeply what's going on, and we're exhausted and tired and whatever, then, you know, the mountain climbing or the jumping out of airplanes kind of thing can feel like that's really life. Great. But it just keeps us, I think, on a kind of, you know, it's superficial level. But what, you know, it doesn't allow us to kind of settle below the surface. So here in retreat, it's here at our re-entry. We're here to enter into and discover and be present. And it involves starting a journey. I think the idea of a journey, I think, is maybe meaningful. The Buddha left the palace and began a journey. He set forth to experience this life, to understand it, to question it, to experience, to be present for himself. And so we start a journey. And one of the reasons I think is useful to think of it as a journey is that then we respect that it's a gradual process. Sometimes people have this black and white thinking, on and off thinking, that either I've gotten it right or I haven't. Either I'm enlightened or I don't. I'm not. And either I'm doing it right or I'm doing it wrong. And I don't think it's useful, that kind of thinking. It's more useful, it's a journey you set forth. And it's a slow process of development, of growth, and of discovery. So that one of the meanings of being awake is to be awake to something, to see clearly, to no longer be asleep, to wake up and no longer be asleep so you can see what's here. You know, there's a beautiful, I think it's kind of beautiful because it's such a profound expression. Represents some real waking up and growing up and facing of truth is when people say the English expression, "What was I thinking?" What was I thinking? And, you know, and it could go on. You know, sometimes we wake up after, 30 years? Sometimes we wake up after 10 years or 5 years or, you know, what was I thinking? What was I thinking when I got involved with him? What was I thinking when I took that job? What was I thinking when I, you know, whatever it might be? What was I thinking when I bought that thing? How many t-shirts do I need? Came home and can't get my t-shirt into my drawer because my drawer is full of t-shirts I haven't worn. But one more t-shirt, what was I thinking? What did I think that t-shirt was going to do for me? And so again, you know, that could be anything, right? I think there are people who overextended themselves in the economic boom. There was all this promise of endless economic growth. And so now there's lots of people saying, what was I thinking? Because they're bankrupt now. So what was I thinking to wake up, you know, to see what's here clearly? And the way I kind of like to interpret Buddhism is that Buddhism is not world negating. It's also not world affirming. The idea of being and negating and affirming is not the game that Buddhism is playing. There are many people who really like to play that game. They really want to have some worldview, philosophy that tells them that this world is a good place, this world is a bad place, and we have to kind of check out. I don't think Buddhism is playing that game. I like to think of Buddhism as being not affirming, not denying or negating, but rather realistic. So in realistic, it means, from my eyes, is willingness to see the whole spectrum of what this life is about. To see that life has tremendous potential and opportunities for beauty and joy. And it also has tremendous possibility and potential for horror and suffering and danger. And how do we wake up to both? How do we learn to hold it both? How do we relate to it, and how do we, not only how do we relate to it, but how do we live in this world, given the nature of this world? How can we live in this world? You know, what is the most important thing for us to do in this precious life that we have? What is it that gives us the most meaning? What is it that brings us to the end of our life so that we can look back at our life and feel that was a life well lived? As opposed to looking back and feeling regret for never having left our palace, never having took chances, never tried to find out what's really going on here, or never found out who we are. Who are you, really? So retreat is a time of entry, of showing up, of being here and connecting and finding out what is here. And the first day of a retreat is often not an easy time for people. And I don't know how it's been for many of you today, but I imagine at least a good percentage of you it's not necessarily easy. There's often tiredness. It's not uncommon for people to get headaches. It's even sometimes people get nauseous a little bit. We don't advertise that, of course. You know, come and get headache and nausea. or the mind is just like out of control. And it just, you know, doesn't want to settle down at all. I mean, you know, Andre gave us wonderful instructions about, you know, being with the breath and the art of meditation and, you know, wet breath. You know, I caught a breath this afternoon. Finally, you know, there was at 1:31, I think there was a breath. But my mind is so spinning out, so busy, so active, you know, it seems impossible to be present. Or strong emotions come through. And it isn't a mistake to have these things happen. It isn't that you're doing this wrong. A very significant thing that happens the first days of a retreat is that our life catches up to us. And if we're always busy and very active, we can keep a lot of things at bay. And there's a backlog of things. Or we can live unhealthy ways. And those unhealthy ways have their consequences, that if we stop living that way, it catches up to us. So for example, if you drink a lot of caffeine, and then suddenly you stop, you have to deal with a headache for a few days. Most people do, I think. And that's part of the cost of always being pumped up that way by caffeine. If you're always, pushing yourself and pushing yourself, then the way you catch up to yourself beginning of retreat is the tiredness. And some people don't realize how exhausted they are until they come on retreat. And the exhaustion is so deep sometimes. I mean, the deepest core of the mind, the brain, is weary from a lifetime of struggling and trying, being anxious or something. So it's a big change, and so things have to shift and change and reorient or settle out or do something. And there's a transition where that has to happen. Sometimes there are strong feelings that haven't had a chance to come forth because we're always busy or always distracting ourselves or something. And so finally when we stop, like we do here in retreat, the emotions that we have that have been untended to or needed to be tended to finally come up. So instead of feeling, you thought you were coming to this beautiful Buddhist retreat. Buddhism, of course, is about, of course, right, about peace and bliss and floating on clouds and, being serene and being really wise. And you couldn't wait to come here because you're going to be so Buddha-like and live happily ever after. And then you show up and the first thing that happens perhaps is rage, murderous rage or doubt that you could imagine this degree of doubt that was in your mind. Or it could be grief, backlog of grief, or it could be anything. Or it could just simply be a discovery for the first time of what your mind tends to think about. And there are people who can spend a lifetime not really aware, not really tracking what the common themes of their minds are, the common patterns of what their mind thinking, their concerns are about. And it can be a shock to discover, that I'm always greedy, I'm always wanting, I'm always planning. It's all I do is plan about some future that will never arrive. I remember there was a woman who came on this retreat a few years ago, and she was shocked to discover how much she sang songs to herself, has music coming up in her mind. And she knew it happened in daily life some, but she didn't think about it too much. But here she was really surprised how much was operating for her. And it became a hindrance to really be present, to really meditate or wake up and really see what was going on clearly. So then her instructions were to look at that. That's what's happening. Look at that carefully. And I asked her to look at, to try to notice what happens just before the music begins. And she's kind of like, I think she was a little bit confused. It's not a warning. I'm not paying attention before. It just happens. But she tried, and then she noticed after some days that the music began whenever there was something that could be called a transition during the day. So anything that would involve a change from one thing to another, like getting up from the sitting to go to walking, or going to the meal, or going to the bathroom, any kind of transition. And she realized that that's when the music began, and she realized that the transitions were, this was a very confident person, capable, confident, you know, person. But there was a little kind of anxiety that came up. And she had trained herself from the time she was a child, when there was big anxiety in her scene, to use music to comfort herself. And so she finally saw that on retreat. You know, that's what she kind of caught up to her. And she got to see what was going on. So the first day, you know, it's not often not easy. It's not easy to get concentrated and whatever. But please don't get discouraged by that. It's really a noble thing. It's a wonderful thing to keep showing up and to be present for it. A lot happens here that's not your doing. Just the fact that you're here in the silence, in the schedule, in this kind of mode, trying to do your best, things are happening kind of outside of your efforts. You're relaxing, you're settling down, things are showing themselves up. You know, I think it's wonderful if you can trust this process that you're in and let it take its time. Over the days, you'll see that things will shift and change. And it's best if you don't take too much credit for how things unfold here. Don't take credit in a negative way, you know, blaming yourself for all the difficulties that might come up. And don't take credit for the good things that happen. But rather, your job, same thing, but you know, don't be affirming, don't be negating about the world. Don't be affirming about yourself, and don't be negating about yourself. Just keep showing up. Be realistic. And the practice here is to keep waking up to this. Now, one of the meanings of waking up that I'm fond of, or one of the associations I have with it, is associate the waking up, like the Buddhist, you know, become awakened, with conventional waking up. And you know, I don't know how it is for all of you. Some people have, you know, in all kinds of different circumstances that can make this difficult. But perhaps sometime in your life, you had a situation where you woke up from a really refreshing nap. And maybe it was a beautiful day, and maybe the beautiful light was coming into your room, and it's very peaceful and setting and situation. And you didn't have to go anywhere right away, and so you woke up and you were just really clear. You woke up, and there was this clarity there. And in that clarity, there's a number of factors which are present. There's you know, some a little heightened kind of mindfulness or knowing. You know, you kind of clearly kind of know, oh, look at that light that's coming in so clearly through the window, or look out the window and you can see the leaves, it's so green. Or wow, you know, sometimes you can even look down at the folds of your blanket. Well, those folds, the way they're folds are just really, that's something that's beautiful, to see the waves of the folds of the blanket. I mean, you know, it seems like a silly thing, right? But there's a kind of heightened mindfulness, heightened appreciation of what you see, what you're aware of. There is maybe a little bit of investigation or curiosity. What is this? You look more carefully at those leaves. You look more carefully at the light and kind of study it and look more closely at what it is. In that kind of waking up from a nap, there is a kind of energy that's there. Kind of maybe you don't feel energized exactly. It's kind of this invisible energy. But you're certainly not tired. You're certainly not, you know, dull. But you're not hyped up either. But there's kind of this clear, invisible kind of being energized that, you know, you're not going to fall asleep. Your eyes are open, you're looking, you're aware, you're listening, and there's energy there. There is perhaps some kind of sense of delight or joy or satisfaction in what's going on, just kind of very simple, maybe innocent. Kind of, this is very satisfying to be this way. Nothing needs to happen, I don't need to attain anything. I'm sitting satisfying. I'm just here. Just here. And perhaps there's some stability of the mind, or some concentration. You know, you look at the light coming in through the window, and as it dances all the dust, amazing amount of dust, right? Dust dances in the light. It's kind of amazing to watch the play, and you're really focused. You have the ability to stay there and really study it. And sometimes it can be absorbed looking at it because the ability of the mind to get concentrated is there. And then there's equanimity. There's a certain kind of equanimity here, meaning you're not likely to react for or against things really strongly. Someone knocks on your bedroom door and says, "You left the dish, dirty dishes in the sink." And you say, "Oh." You hear that. As opposed to jumping up and running down there or being so apologetic or being angry and how could you disturb me? It's like there's a certain kind of space in the mind to hear that and receive that. Not to dismiss it, but you're not automatic. The emotions are not automatically triggered in the usual way. There's an equanimity, there's a balance of mind, there's a receptivity of the mind that holds it in a balanced, open way. And then you say, "I'm sorry, I'll go clean the dishes," or whatever you need to say. So those are the seven factors of awakening, which we'll talk about in the next days, since they're so closely connected to awakening. But I think that that little exercise, I found it interesting for myself, because many of the things that Buddhism points to are things that we've already experienced in our life in small ways. And Buddhism is trying to not bring something new into our lives necessarily, but rather to augment and develop what's already a natural thing, already happening for us, what's already something we're familiar with in some small way. So with the seven factors of awakening, as practice develops, those become more stable and richer and more frequent part of our lives. They don't become something that just happens in a lucky nap that we wake up and they're there. Also, the quality of awakefulness, waking up from a nap, and this equanimity of it, you're not for things and not against things waking up from the nap. It's like, that kind of, at least this, maybe it's mythic nap waking up that I'm talking about, but there's equanimity, there's this openness, this calm that, you just kind of, this is how it is. There's space to experience it all. And one of the things we're trying to do with mindfulness is to be awake. And to be awake, so it's kind of unfortunate how much mindfulness has entered into our popular culture. I think it's time for us Buddhists to probably get rid of that word. And because, let the other people use it now. And we should probably come up with a new word because we have so many associations with it and meanings and what's supposed to happen when you're mindful and what it looks like and, it's just so much garbage. And but one of the things, associations that people sometimes have with mindfulness is like work. And you're supposed to kind of see in some deep way or you're supposed to, something's supposed to happen if you're mindful. But at least for me, the idea of being awake to something as opposed to being mindful to something, to be awake to something, I think allows things to be as they are. When you're awake to something, you're not necessarily judging it. You're not necessarily saying that shouldn't be there or should be different or need to hold on to it. You're not trying to become a really good Buddhist by practicing your mindfulness. You're not trying to sharpen up your mindfulness, be mindful here, note this and note this. To be awake is, I think, it's just to be present for what's happening in an open way without being in opposition to it or without needing to do something with it, not appropriating it, without identifying with it. So to be, to be awake is to be attentive. But maybe it's a kind of attentiveness of a naturalist who doesn't interfere with the nature she's studying. She's in the woods studying some animals. She doesn't interfere with the life of the animal, but she just studies, sees, not for or against, but just studies how it is. So to be awake as opposed to be mindful, perhaps that's be interesting for you to experiment here and see if that change of vocabulary can give you a different idea of what we're trying to do when we're being mindful. we're not, you know, just it's enough to be awake to what's happening. It's enough to be awake to your grief, to your anger, to your tiredness, to your aching legs. It's enough to be awake to the fact that your mind is distracted. It's enough to be awake to the fact that mostly you're not. You know, for a moment, well, look, that's what's happening. My mind is very busy and distracted. So in this regard, some of you have heard me say this before, but there's a practice that I'm very fond of, way of doing this, if I can dare say mindfulness again, mindfulness. I'm very fond, when my mind is busy, it's hard to show up and be present, I'm very fond of using the practice of here. And I actually say in my mind the word here, H-E-R-E. And it's a reminder to be here. One of the reasons I like the word here is that it's not judgmental. It's not trying to be some other place. It's not there. It's enough to be here. And it's here. And to be awake, what's here? What's here? Well, here is a mind which is distracted. Here is a person who is afraid. Here. This is what's like here. Occasionally, I've imagined that I'm a visitor from Mars, anthropologist from Mars, and who somehow enter into my brain. And it's just really, and this anthropologist is really fascinated. He's never been inside a human being before. And there's no judgments of anything. So, wow, that's how it is in there. Here, it's like this. Naturalist from Mars. So it's here. And not as a command, as you would for a dog, here. But more like here, as if you're turning yourself inside out to make space for what is here, to discover what's here, to see what's here, to be informed by what's here, to experience what's here without any thing that needs to happen, without needing to get anywhere, without needing to get concentrated or get more mindful or whatever you think might have to happen. You have these ideas of what's supposed to happen. But here. And so when I use it when my mind is most busy. So what happens is I say here, it works great for a second, and the mind goes off. So then I say here again. And I say the word here in a way that's not judgmental, it's not assertive, it's not mean. It's a simple, kind, at ease kind of here. And then I see what is here. And so I might have to do it for a while, but generally if I do this for a while, and then the mind that wants to be so busy and spin out tends to quiet down. And when it's quiet down after a while, and then I stop doing the here, and then I can start doing more like the breath meditation in a more easier way, more productive way. Is it better to get your mind quiet down so you can finally get concentrated in the breath? Is that better than having a mind that's spinning out? It might be more pleasant, but is it better? I think it's better not to get into that kind of comparative thinking, or not get into some idea that there's someplace else that you need to be in your practice. It might be the most profound thing you do here is to somehow come to terms with how busy your mind is, and really face it and see it. And that actually might be more transformative for you than it is those minutes where you finally get concentrated and still. Or maybe the moments when you get finally concentrated and still show you a possibility of inner peace, of happiness, that is independent from all the kind of things you thought you had to do to get peaceful. That's transformative. I don't know. We don't know ahead of time what's going to be most meaningful for you. So I think what's best is don't get. You don't need to start interpreting the meaning of what's going on. Just wake up to what's here. And trust that the lessons you need to learn, the world you need to enter into, will teach you, will show to you. You'll find, it'll become clear over time what this is about. You don't have to be ahead of yourself. You can be very spacious or allowing. If you just are, you know, here, or to be awake to this. And then, as I said last night, one of the aspects of being awake, of waking up, is we wake up, we awaken things that are inside. We wake up things that are long asleep or undeveloped. And some of those things that wake up are not necessarily good news or pleasant. I remember Ed Brown gave a story once. It's kind of a sad story. It's an analogy. So, of some people, family had a dog who would wake up in the middle of the night and kind of roam around the house a little bit, make some noise, and so it woke up the people in the house. So they didn't like waking up, so what they did was they put the dog in the basement. But the dog really didn't like to be in the basement, so the dog started barking in the basement. So then they got a double door for the basement and left the dog in the basement because they didn't want to deal with this noisy dog. It's a problem dog. And the dog got more and more angry and disturbed and afraid of being left. It would bark more and snarl, and they would throw food down, and he'd be like this vicious, wild dog by then. And it's, you know, better leave him in the basement. We could ignore him down there. We could live our life just fine. You know, just we don't have to go. We don't need the basement. You know, we just leave it down there. And the dog just gets more and more something. Sooner or later, the dog has to be let out. And because of the way it's been treated, it'll come out. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to take a while to befriend the dog again. It takes a while to teach the dog well. And it takes its time for the dog to relearn that it can trust you. So some of us have kind of put things in our basement, and the waking up process is that, you know, our dogs show themselves, and we have to be very kind and take our time and show what is most afraid or most angry or most grieving, that it can trust us, that we can be friendly towards it, that we can just make space for it and say, here, come, I'll be with you. One of the lessons that I've taught my kids is I would tell the stories when they were small of terrible, hideous monsters. They would come. It's scary, and come down the road. You know, there's a kid there, and it looks like it's bad news. And the kid just turns around and looks at the monster and says, I'd like to be your friend. And the monster says, ah, finally, someone wants to be my friend. Ah, yeah, I'll play with you. So, it's true in real life, too. More than half the time, that those scary people, they probably, you know, want to be friends if you give them, if you show them that, if you show them how. So sometimes what's woken is our sleeping dogs. But sometimes it's the sleeping tigers. It's beautiful, courageous, strong aspects of our personality in life. And I think that's one of the functions of Buddhist practice, is to allow the beauty in us to wake up. Buddhist psychology divides up has two major classes of mind states or mental factors of the mind. There's all kinds of two major categories and some minor ones, but the two major ones are, on one hand, there's the unskillful states of mind. I like the word unskillful because not judgmental. It just means, you know, like the bad states or the... It's just those which aren't useful. Those which are not helpful. The unskillful states of mind. But then you think that the opposite category would be the skillful states of mind. But the, what instead Buddhist psychology calls them the beautiful states of mind. The beautiful states of mind. Isn't that beautiful? So this process then of learning to let go of the unskillful is to allow so that what's beautiful can bloom in us and grow in us. But in order to do that, we have to first learn, many of us have to first learn, how to be really skillful about the unskillful, how to relate to what's difficult with dignity, with courage, with with an attitude of kindness, generosity, compassion. You have to learn how to relax around what's going on here, not continue the fight. And it could be that it's the big part of what practice is working with the difficulties. Or to say it another way, I'll say it this way, this is meant to be provocative. And hopefully it's near the end of a long talk, it's you're still awake enough to be provoked. For the most part, Buddhist practice begins when it doesn't work. Isn't that provocative? Because if it worked, like if you sat down, like you know, if I could sit, you know, it just works perfectly, right? You sit down, you come to retreat, you made a lot of effort to come here. I'm going to do it. It's going to work perfectly. I sit down, get concentrated, enlightened, and just happily ever after. That's the way. If it worked, that's the way it'd be, right? But mostly, it doesn't work, and that's why we have to practice. And we're so lucky to have a practice. And the tradition in Buddhism is you should be really celebrate and be happy that you have a practice. Not that your practice that works, that you do when it doesn't work. So don't be discouraged if it doesn't work. It's because it doesn't work that we have the practice. And the more it doesn't work, the more beneficial it is. Because the more you have to face and enter into and see and learn something. So don't be discouraged at all because you think it didn't work very well today. That's where practice begins. That's where we have to find ourselves. That's the entry point. That's where you leave the palace. That's where you have to face something. And one of the things that facing it, moving towards it, leaving the palace and going towards it, and understanding it and making space for it, not to allow yourself to keep indulging and, you know, thinking and all that, but to really face it, is so you can also learn how to relate to it with generosity, with nobility, with dignity, with courage, with kindness, with compassion. To relate to it in such a way that the way we relate to it, are the very qualities that we're trying to awaken through enlightenment, through being awake. So we don't necessarily have to wait for awakening, for this big bang thing. That's which is difficult. We begin training there. How can I hold this without clinging, without aversion? How can I hold this without getting caught up in all my judgments and interpretations of what it means? How can I be present for this without tying it in to my identity, to all the ways in which I represent myself to myself and all the interpretations of who I am? Just let it be there. I'm really tired. Can you say be generous through the tiredness in such a way that it's just tiredness? I'll work the best I can. I'll try to be awake, sit up straight, open my eyes if I have to. But I don't need to use my tiredness as a reason to say, I'm a bad person. I'm a Buddhist failure. I am this guy. I'll never, you know, or whatever. I'll never get concentrated. I'll be the person who's... That's extra. That's not being awake. To be awake is tired. That's what's happening now. Here, there's tiredness. Here, it's hard. So the theme for this week is awakening. And so I hope that some of these ideas that I've offered you today have provoked you appropriately and given you something to experiment with and practice with. And I hope that you find it really fascinating or interesting or meaningful, purposeful, to begin entering into your life in a deeper way, to attempt to try to discover more fully what's really going on here and now. Because the lived life, the real life, is not necessarily at Hidden Villa, it's not necessarily back at work or anywhere else. The real life is the lived life. And these conditions of the retreat are really good conditions, the silence, the stillness, to really enter into the lived life and discover something new maybe you haven't seen before. May this retreat be a re-entry for you. Full and deep, complete re-entry into your lived life. So, thank you.